Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Austin Common Radio Hour. I'm your host, Amy Stansbury, and today we're starting a series on an issue that is top of mind for many Austinites: homelessness. I decided to start off 2024 by diving deeper into this issue for several reasons. One, when I go to council meetings or just talk to people in our community about the biggest issues facing Austin, homelessness gets brought up more than almost any other issue. And two, there seems to be a lot of confusion about what our city is actually doing about homelessness, who's in charge of what, how much money we're spending, and where it's all going. And number three, I live in the city, and I have for 10 years, and like many of you, I see the human suffering on our city streets each and every day, and I'm always left thinking, like, why? So I've been talking with a lot of people who have been dealing with this crisis up close. Nonprofit leaders, elected officials, and even regular Austinites who have gotten together to help their neighbors in need. And one thing that I'm trying to do first with this project is just gain a better understanding of what our homelessness services system actually looks like. Because how can you know what's missing if you don't really know how it works in the first place? So my goal is to kind of track it all the way through, from the moment someone first loses their housing to eventually getting back into permanent stable housing again. Or not. So there are many different places we can start here, but if you were to suddenly find yourself experiencing homelessness in Austin, one of the first places you might go is the Sunrise Homeless Navigation Center in South Austin. That's where the Sunrise Hub is located, which is a day center open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. that provides a wide variety of services, from hot meals to showers to connections to housing and shelter. The Hub and Navigation Center is based out of the Sunrise Community Church. Back in 2015, they started helping people in their community that were experiencing homelessness. And that small effort and idea kept growing and growing. And now today, Sunrise is the number one, in terms of volume, provider of homelessness services in all of Austin. The executive director of Sunrise Homeless Navigation Center is Mark Hibbelink. He says that nothing they're doing at Sunrise is like rocket science, but that they really focus on listening to the needs of the people they're serving and then filling that need. So to learn more about the services Sunrise provides, let's listen in on that interview I recorded with Mark.
We really designed our hub to solve a major issue in the community, which is that most homeless services are segmented according to the different types of needs. And so for someone experiencing homelessness, that would look like having to go to one place for food, one place for showers, one place for mental health care, one place for mail, one place for physical health care. And our dream from the beginning was to kind of to close those gaps and to kind of bring everything under one roof so that you could have a one-stop shop for people who needed to get all the things that they needed from under a bridge into an apartment. And so that's really what we've created at the Hub. I think by far it's the place in town that has more of those things integrated together into one space than anywhere else. And I think that's probably why it's become so popular. And so some of those are provided not only on certain days, but most of those are provided at least once every week. It's pretty readily available for other agencies to be able to use our space as well to base some of their services out as well. For us, one of the underlying principles is that homelessness is trauma. And that doesn't sound revolutionary, but it kind of is, because if you think about it, like, I think a lot of us, especially in 2023 or four, now I guess it's 2024, have come to the understanding that trauma is important, an important part of like how people see the world. And I think people understand homelessness as a creator of trauma or as a result of trauma, and they treat it accordingly. But what they oftentimes don't consider is that homelessness is trauma, right? So it's a traumatic thing. And because it's a currently existing trauma, like, you wouldn't go up to somebody who's currently experiencing a traumatic situation and be like, hey, why don't you get a job? Right? Like, I'm not going to the ER where your mom's dying and like walking up to you and being like, you should get to work.
Right.
Right. Like, you're not in a good brain space for that. And so I think that we've always kind of operated on like a model where you have to address the theory of needs. Like, you have to address the base level needs to create the foundation to address the bigger needs. And so unfortunately, there just hasn't been a lot of recognition by the funders. And by funders, I mean oftentimes county and city and state and federal governments, that if you want to achieve the nicer, cleaner parts of homeless services, like the housing and the mental health care and the physical health care, then you have to start with the dirtier parts of homeless services, which are the, clothes and the food and the bathrooms and the showers and the mail and that kind of stuff. And it doesn't work real well to start halfway up the needs pyramid.
Right, because ostensibly, like if you're someone who is experiencing homelessness, you wake up in the morning, you have to take care of all of these maybe immediate needs like eating and bathing and getting water or whatever. And maybe by the time you do all that, then when do you have time to like go to a office or
Well,
wherever and also.
or 10 offices, right? Like, and that I think is a huge part of the challenge, right? Like, I always tell people there's far more people that come here for a hamburger and get housing services than come here for housing services and eat a hamburger, right? Like, if we were not serving food, we would probably serve a lot less people. I don't love, to be honest, I don't love serving food. It's not my favorite thing. I'm not super wild about it. I worked in a restaurant when I was a kid. I kind of never wanted to ever again. But the reality is that, like, for most people, they're going to identify their primary need first, especially if they're in trauma. And so reaching them with the things they need is really important. The other thing that's really important about our day center, I think it's important, is that homeless services, in addition to all the things we've already talked about, also tends to be very haphazard and what I'd like to call drive-by, right? And so outreach services are important. They really are. But they're also very random and they're very inefficient because you've got to go find people. Having a stable place that's open every single day of the year that you can lean on and expect and know that it's going to be there is not only like a functional foundation, but it's a psychological foundation to know that you've got a steady like home base that you can go back to, and that you have that. If everything else falls apart, you've got that. And that's why day centers are important, because they're kind of the backbone of the housing system. Because if you need a mobile caseworker, you can't just go find them. They're finding you, right? And so I think like having spots where people can go that have all of those things is a really important piece of the system.
I want to talk about another thing you offer at the day center, which I think the people might not think about very much either, which is mail services.
Yep.
Can you talk about like why that matters and kind of how before you, why that's important.
Yeah. One of my favorite facts about the Sunrise Hub is that if we were a city, we would be larger than 80% of the cities in Texas in terms of mail sorting. And so for all of the postal employees who work in those 80% of the Texas cities, they can look up to my volunteers who sort the mail every day and realize how much work they're doing. But no, mail is incredibly important because a stable mailbox. I think what a lot of people don't realize is, if you are being alerted that you have a place via the housing authority, even if you're homeless, the housing authority notifies you via snail mail, which is, if you think about that for a moment, is insane. But that's the reality. And then if you don't get your letter or it bounces back, then you get passed up. The other reality is if one or usually one, but sometimes two, one or two letters from Social Security. If you get Social Security income, either from retirement or disability, one or two letters bounce back to Social Security, they will literally cut your money off.
Oh my gosh.
And if that happens for a matter of a few months, you could literally lose your entire case and have to start all over again. Same thing with food stamps. You cannot get food stamps unless you have an address, and they mail you your replacement card.
And they mail you your Social Security check too?
A lot, yeah. For some of them, usually they try to get it onto a debit card. But even if you have it on a debit card, if you can't get mail to get the, because they're constantly. You've probably never been on Social Security, but if you're on Social Security, they send you letters all the time. Like you probably get 6 to 7 letters a month, and if any of those bounces, they'll cut your money off. And so yeah, so having a mailbox and a reliable mailbox is incredibly important. And so, yeah, there's several providers here in town who provide that service. Obviously, Sunrise provides the largest one of those, but it's such an essential service for folks. We even find sometimes when folks do get housed, but they're housed in more like kind of iffy circumstances, kind of marginally housed people, they still will maintain their addresses here because of our stability. And that's the name of the game in homeless services is stability, and it's what homeless services unfortunately has very little of. From an organizational or from a staffing standpoint, but that's what people really ultimately need. When your life is completely chaotic and unstable, like you're literally just looking for something to hold on to. I equate it to kind of like flailing in the open ocean. Like all you want if you're flailing in the open ocean is like a piece of driftwood to grab onto that's big enough to hold you up, right? You just need one handle to grab onto one thing to allow you to relax long enough to kind of like recapture yourself and then go and help yourself. And like in homelessness, that's what people are experiencing, just kind of a constant flailing without any sort of thing to grab onto. And so for them, I think a lot of what Sunrise is like we're the thing they grab onto and begin to like rest for a moment and then get back to it and kind of try to pursue resolving their homelessness.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think too. I know another thing that you all are doing is coordinated assessment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I know that's like an essential part to getting housing and housing support services for, you know, a lot of the, you know, I guess at least anything that's federally funded, right? You have to take this coordinated assessment. Well, first explain what that coordinated assessment looks like and what some of the barriers have been for people to take that coordinated assessment.
Yeah, great question. There's like 100 trails I could go on here, so I'm gonna try and keep it like top level. Coordinated assessment is essentially a standardized vulnerabilities intake that helps the system understand who are the people that need the scarce resources the most. And so the example I always give to people is like, let's say you and me and my grandma are going on a camping trip together. And I let you pack the car, and so you forgot, and you only put two cots in the car, so only two of us are going to get cots. Now we're at the campsite, and we've got two cots and three people. How are we going to decide who gets the cots, right? If we decide who can get to the trunk the fastest to get them, it's probably going to be you and me. If we think about like who needs it the most, it's probably grandma. And so in a system where we probably have resources to help like one out of 10 people, we have to decide how those resources, whether they're shelter or whether they're housing, get distributed to those people fairly and equitably. And so at its core, the goal of coordinated entry, coordinated assessment is to put people on a vulnerability scale and say, these are the people, if we have a limited amount of apartments, which we're always going to have, if we have a limited amount of shelter space, which we're always going to have, who are the people that need it the most? And so then you kind of work from the top of the list down. And so that is, it also is the only way to access, like you said, the only way to access any federally funded program. So even if you're going to Community First, or if you're going to like a housing authority property, you have to do that assessment as part of that. And so it's an essential piece. Basically, you're invisible to the system of housing unless you've taken that assessment.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think surprised me the most, you know, I was reading through one of Echo's needs and gaps reports, and they kind of measure or time out the time in between all these different stages that someone might go through, you know, getting a coordinated assessment, getting referred to a program, actually getting housing. I know that you know, I think it's obvious that very few people end up into the housing stage because we don't have enough resources, but I was surprised, like I think it said, you know, the median number of days from someone experiencing homelessness for the first time to getting a coordinated assessment was 120. The mean was 463 days. And I was like, wow, why does it take so long for someone to get that super basic thing that just puts you on what could be a really long wait list? I assume you might have some insights into why that is. Can you explain or think about what you've seen?
Again, there's lots of reasons for it. Some of them are political, so I'll try to stay out of those. But the best reason I can explain that with is there's not money for it. So again, if you want to go back to what we said earlier, what is the driving force behind most of the nonsensical pieces of the homeless system? It's money. Nobody wants to fund assessment, right? People want to fund housing. Some people want to fund food. Nobody wants to fund assessment. And so the reality is that there's just a lot of people who don't do it.
But you can't get housing without the assessment.
100%. So in some communities, they've said, if you're going to be a housing provider, you that also have to do the assessments because it's part of the process. That's not true in our community. And so Sunrise is a great question for me because Sunrise, I think by the last Echo data count has done about 80% of these over the last 12 months. Like we do like four out of every five. And we're doing it because we recognize that it is so vitally important. We're being funded for some of it, but a lot of it we're not being funded for.
And that was Mark Hibbelink from the Sunrise Homeless Navigation Center. As Mark mentioned, Sunrise does conduct the majority of coordinated assessments given in Austin and Travis County. The most recent numbers put that at about 4,759 coordinated assessments given in 2023, which accounted for about 58% of all coordinated assessments given in Travis County that year. But Sunrise is not the only provider in town. In fact, Austin's homeless network is made up of lots and lots of different organizations that provide all different kinds of services and have different approaches for doing it. And untangling this vast network of homeless service providers is extremely confusing and complex, and we're going to talk with a lot of them over the course of this series. But for now, one other organization you should definitely know about is called ECHO, which is the Ending Community Homeless Coalition. ECHO is a local nonprofit organization and the lead agency of something called the Austin-Travis County Continuum of Care. Basically, the federal government requires the community to pick a single organization to apply for federal homelessness funds and grants, which then get distributed to other organizations in town. And so as this lead agency, ECHO is also responsible for conducting the point-in-time count, which is kind of like a census for people experiencing homelessness. And they also maintain a lot of the data we have about homelessness in our community, since they interact with a lot of other organizations. And also because of this role as lead agency, they help to manage the coordinated assessment system and something called HMIS, which is the Homeless Management Information System, which is kind of like a database of everyone who has taken the coordinated assessment and kind of the different services available in our community. And all of this is required by the federal government in order to receive funding. Anyway, to explain it all for us and dive a little deeper, and to give us a bigger picture of the system in Austin, I spoke with Alessandra Dominguez. She's the director of the Crisis Response System for ECHO. Let's listen in on that interview now. And to start, you're going to hear me asking Alessandra to clear up a bit of the jargony words that you hear when we talk about homelessness. Okay, so coordinated assessment, that's that process that people are going through. It's like an interview. Coordinated entry is just the name for what, the entire system?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. I sometimes see those words kind of used, and I sometimes not sure if it's interchangeably or what exactly.
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah. And I do that like all the time. I'm like, I always have to be like, the coordinated entry system is the whole system that we're all the providers are working in, and we're coordinating our services. And coordinated assessment is a coordinated assessment that allows us to prioritize, because we don't, and the whole reason to prioritize is because we don't have enough permanent housing resources. So we have to prioritize in some way.
Right. And so that coordinated assessment, it's like an interview, right? Or a conversation that someone might have. It's maybe like an outreach worker or what have you, sits down, talks with this person experiencing homelessness, and what, ask them questions kind of about their experience, their medical background. What kind of things go into that coordinated assessment?
Yeah, so you're correct. That assessment is done either when an individual comes into shelter or street outreach. We also have a few medical community health paramedics doing that assessment, as well as like integral care, so mental health professionals as well. And the way that we kind of do vulnerability is we're looking at somebody's history of housing of homelessness, how long they've experienced homelessness, how many episodes they've had, their wellness, so their physical, their mental, any chronic health conditions, and then any barriers into housing, meaning have they maybe been housed and had to leave housing because they had a serious medical or mental health situation and fell into homelessness? And then do they have any support? Are they already connected to resources? Things of that nature.
Okay,
kind
gotcha.
Of how we measure vulnerability.
Right. And I've talked to some outreach workers about this. And my understanding is people literally get like a score in the system that kind of helps to determine that. And like the higher the score, the higher your vulnerability, maybe you get better priority to maybe get placed into one of these housing programs.
Yes. Yeah. So with the coordinated assessment, then it kind of after the yes or no kind of questions, then it gives you a score. And the assessment itself doesn't necessarily, the job of that assessment isn't to say, okay, you're 100% a great fit for permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing. It allows us as a system to be able to say, this is your vulnerability. And then there's also subpopulations that are tied to it as well. So our communities also does the most vulnerable, but also tax on subpops, meaning if you're a veteran, if you're an individual fleeing domestic violence, if you're youth, somebody younger than 25 and younger, certain subpops also have a higher priority because there are housing providers that only serve those individuals.
Right.
So you'll be prioritized a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm. And so my understanding too of the prioritization, again, is based on vulnerability, those with the highest level of need, which I totally understand given limited resources. But then at the same time, I'm sure it's like, it's tough because then what? It's like the people who obviously are still very vulnerable, they're homeless, mm-hmm. but they're not like vulnerable enough. Is the alternative, it's like then they just kind of have to wait and maybe get worse. Is that kind of like the downside of this having so few resources right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's kind of the reality. So working at ECHO and our job is to monitor and seeing, since we're all kind of coordinating our services with coordinated entry system, it allows us to see our gaps in the system. And that is an obvious gap, right? Like we're assessing so many people and our system as a whole can only house this many individuals. So it gets very small and narrow, and it is, well, what happens to everybody outside of here? And that was something that we started realizing, which is then where a self-resolution kind of comes into play, meaning diversion. So a lot of, we've actually kind of gotten into the funding game and realized we're seeing these individuals that are still very vulnerable, but maybe aren't going to be able to be housed in a more traditional housing placement because they're not that vulnerable. But can they be diverted? Meaning, can we help them self-resolve their homelessness with financial assistance? And that's what diversion is. So let's say you found a job, you've been experiencing homelessness for a year and a half, you found a job, you and your friend both have a job, and you got accepted to an apartment complex, but you don't have enough money for deposits and all of those things. You could come to several organizations in the homeless response system, and they could help provide that financial assistance to cover that and then help you end your homelessness. So you maybe had taken that coordinated assessment a year ago, but you're still working the system. You're still working with other providers. And then you only have this roadblock of a small financial assistance service that you need. Our system saw that and started putting money into diversion to help clients that are kind of that catch 22 that aren't as vulnerable, help self-resolve their homelessness.
And so did we not really have a lot of diversion programs before? Like when did you all kind of start being like, oh, this is an area we need to invest in?
Yeah, so in 2015, actually, ECHO started kind of seeing that, and it was a theory. It was like, well, let's see what we can do. We're meeting with people. We're hearing from assessors that if only I could get a money I got displaced here for work. If only I could get back to Wisconsin. I have family there. I'm like, well, geez, that Wisconsin ticket, plane ticket, bus, Greyhound is $200. Like, that's all we need to end this person's homelessness. So we started doing some fundraising, and we were able to get a small pot of money and started purchasing those types of things to help people end their homelessness. And with that data and doing it for several years, we were getting a lot of agencies reaching out to ECHO. Hey, we have this situation. We just need this much money. And we would pay for it. And people were ending their homelessness, which is then kind of where the diversion is slowly growing in our community, which is pretty exciting to see. Because that's definitely been where we can help those individuals that we know that may not be able to get served as quickly through our traditional housing.
Right. And so it's like a flexible pot of money. I'm sure there are some restrictions on, but it does give you a little bit more like, okay, we can kind of use this to fit this person's need, be it a bus ticket, be it that deposit or whatever. And what about, it's interesting though, because I think also as like someone who's like looking outside the system or what you would assume, like diversion makes it sound like they were never homeless in the first place.
Yeah.
But it's like, I guess it's still like, it's an int- do we have a lot of programs in our city that help that? Like someone who's like, I think I might become homeless in the next month or two if I don't get X, if I don't get this bill covered that is gonna, or if I don't get, my landlord. I see like even on social media a lot, like people, mutual aid groups being like, we know someone who's $500 short on rent and they're gonna be evicted in 2 days. Like,
yeah.
Do we have, is that part of our homelessness response system or not really, because those people are not homeless?
Exactly. Like that's where it definitely gets hard. So every system has red tape, right? And what you're explaining there is prevention, preventing people from falling into homelessness. Yes, it would help. We do a lot of kind of outreach to hospitals, jail systems, right? Because everything like that then falls into homelessness, but HUD is very strict on their definitions of homelessness. So our system only serves category one and category four of homelessness, meaning you have to be either presenting into homelessness, meaning tonight I have nowhere to go. Maybe last night I slept at my friend's house, but they kicked me out. They may be evicted because I'm there. So tonight I'm presenting into homelessness. I have no resource. Then I can assess those diversion funds. Or I'm fleeing domestic violence, and I could still access those homeless prevention funds. But prevention is still a huge need in our community. But unfortunately, we don't have the capacity as a homeless response system to kind of dip into prevention.
Yeah, definitely. So that's, and when you talk about the funding, that's the federal government. I assume like a nonprofit or the city could be like, hey, we want to invest in prevention and then give those funds out to some nonprofits that might also do homelessness services. But it's like, it's the federal government that's setting those kind of restrictions you're talking about.
Exactly. Yes. And some organizations, when they apply for grants, just like as we started applying for grants for diversion, a lot of those organizations put those restrictions. You can only serve literal homeless individuals.
Oh.
So some grants may not have those restrictions and allow for you to kind of do whatever you want to do. But right, everything sometimes has that like fine print of this is who you can serve.
And grants again are coming from the federal government.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Interesting. And that was Alessandra from ECHO. As she mentioned, part of the reason we have a coordinated assessment and this whole process for prioritizing who receives housing services is that we simply don't have enough of them. In future episodes, we're going to dig deeper into exactly how much of a housing and shelter gap we have, but for now, I was wondering, how does an organization like Sunrise, who is helping so many people navigate our homeless response system, deal with this lack of resources? And for that, we'll go back to Mark Hibbelink.
When we have new employees start, I would say the hardest part about our job is knowing that 9 out of 10 of the people that you serve are not going to get served by the assessment that they're taking. Like it's devastating. Like who would work in a job where you have a 10% success rate, right? Like
for the people taking the assessment, how do you convince people to take an assessment if they feel like, I've talked to other people.
Yeah. And so, and the challenge is there, right? That like, you've got to somehow then say to this like really this really vulnerable person that you know is probably going to like fall victim to like the criminal element and to it's a mental health, environmental mental health issues, drug and alcohol. It's so sad when you see someone for the first night come up, like lose their apartment, come to you the first day and be like, all right, I'm homeless now. I'm ready to go into shelter. I'm ready. And I'm like, they never realized that there isn't shelter, right? Like there
right.
is, I like to see their face drop when they realize, it's amazing. Like in the most terrible way possible. And so it is, yeah, when you're on the hotline, you're literally trying to help people like safety plan, mitigation, right? I would love to send every family who calls our hotline to a shelter that day. The reality is the family shelters are even more backed up than the single adult shelters. And recognize that a lot of those kids are in compromising situations. It is awful. And so, but somebody needs to do it. And like, and that's where like, we make sure that our staff gets good mental health care and like make sure that they take care of themselves, takes breaks. But no, you identified something that's very real and it's very hard.
And is it, does it hurt, you talked about people constantly are coming back to the center also. Does it impact like the trust there? Like, is there any difficulty, with talking to people and saying, you should take this assessment, you got to at least get on the list. But if they're like, it's been 6 months, it's been a year, like I've gotten nothing from this list. Like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I?
No, 100%. And like, folks are not dumb, right? Like, eventually they realize that like, I've done this thing six times and you can only do it every 6 months. That represents like 3.5 years. I've done this thing six times and nothing's coming of it. And we're like, I know, right? So one of the things that we really try to do, I can't speak for everybody in the community. One of the things we really try to do is to say, okay, this person is probably not a prime candidate. And like, it doesn't work like a list where like, if you're on it for 10 years, you eventually will get in. It's like, if you're on it and you're the top person and tomorrow 10 more people become homeless that are more vulnerable than you, you just get bumped back down. And so like, if you're in that lower score range, you're literally just going to be in that spot forever and ever. And so what we've really thought about is how do we empower those people to help resolve their homelessness themselves, right? Some of that could be through like income generation. Some of it could be from like getting creative about what kind of places you're applying, what kind of apartments you're applying to. Some of it might get creative about like finding family members that might be willing to let you live at their house. Some of it might be about like, I've definitely had to do like counseling between two brothers who got in a fight a year ago, but the one brother's like, I'm not letting him back the way that he is. And then we sit down and we have a kumbaya and then they go live together again. Like, there's 100 different ways to solve homelessness. PSH is one of them. And so like, we would be doing our clients a disservice if we only gave them like the coordinated assessment housing options. We make an effort to say, based on our educated opinion, here's some options that you could try out, and never leaving. We make a goal to never send somebody away without some sort of action step that they could take. And because if they don't, and it could be something silly, right? Like go take a shower, right? Like be something really silly, but like people function better when they have action steps that they can take. And so we try to give everybody an actionable plan.
Right. Okay. So the process for someone, maybe they come to your day center, maybe they come a few times, they're just there to get basic needs. You develop a relationship with them. Maybe they take a coordinated assessment, or they meet with you all, or you start to get other things, and they're eligible. Eventually, maybe they get housing, or you work with them, or you have like caseworkers or just employees that are working with them that might be able to figure out other solutions, more creative solutions, at least to get them improving or
on
the path to
like
housing.
I want people working here who are like Swiss Army knives of anything, right? So like, if this one doesn't work, try the next one. If this thing doesn't work, try the next one. If they, like, we want to give you infinite opportunity to succeed. And that means knocking on 100 doors. One of the illustrations that I use with people all the time is I say, getting yourself out of homelessness is very much like fishing. If you ever like are on the coast and you see people fishing, there's some fishing boats that have one line in the water, and there's some fishing boats that have like 14 lines all around their boat, right? The odds of those people with 14 lines getting a fish are much higher than the people with one line, right? Like don't make coordinated entry your only line. Like get all your lines that you possibly are eligible for in the water.
And once again, that was Mark Hibbling from the Sunrise Homeless Navigation Center. So, in today's episode, we talked through what for many is the first kind of step or the beginning of our city's homeless response system. Day centers, where you can go for immediate needs like food and water, and then get connected with our city's coordinated assessment, which is kind of the key to getting most kinds of housing assistance. And we also learned that people can be on these wait lists for a very, very long time. So what happens in the interim? What happens while you're waiting? Both Mark and Alessandra briefly touched on that, you know, with things like those diversion services. But in future episodes, we're going to go further and really show what it's like to be on that list, get into emergency shelter, and then eventually to gain access to housing again. We'll also be sharing the stories and showcasing the voices of actual people who have made this journey into and out of homelessness themselves. I hope you'll join us and so we continue to learn together about the causes and solutions to this important issue in our community. The Austin Common Radio Hour is brought to you in partnership by the Austin Common and Co-op Radio. The Austin Common is a local news source that helps Austinites be informed and make a difference in their community. You can learn more about the Austin Common by visiting theaustincommon.com or following us on Instagram at @the_austin_common. Co-op is a cooperatively run community radio station based in Austin, Texas. To listen to more of Co-op's amazing lineup of shows, visit koop.org or tune in to 91.7 FM. The show is hosted by me, Amy Stansbury, and produced by John Hoffner. You can find podcasts of the Austin Common Radio Hour on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcast. And one quick friendly request on this, if you like our show and you find it useful, please consider rating, reviewing, and subscribing on your favorite podcast app. It really helps us to be seen and heard by more folks in Austin, so thank you in advance if you're able to do that for us. Thanks for listening!